Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, we've got a lot to talk about. First and foremost, Kyrsten Sinema has pretty much single-handedly decided that she is going to kill the effort of Democrats to ensure voting rights for millions of Americans by saying that she doesn't quite agree with removing the filibuster. We'll get into her reasoning a little bit later. We also have Mike Figueredo, the host of the Humanist Report on YouTube. He's going to be joining me to talk about the Democrats' chances of being successful in the midterms and, of course, what Republicans are using as their strategy to come out ahead. And attorney Christopher Palos is going to be joining me to talk about the lawsuit that he and his law firm have filed against Saudi Arabia for the December 6, 2019 terrorist attack in Pensacola, Florida. And don't forget, if you want to get the full show every single week, sign up, become a member at rofpodcast.com. And of course, you can get fresh content from Ring of Fire every single day of the week on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. So this week, actually on Thursday, the House of Representatives managed to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which of course would undo a lot of the damage that we have seen at the state level from Republican-controlled legislatures. And after passing the House, of course, it moves on to the Senate, and that is where the real drama exists. Because without reforming, killing, or doing something about the filibuster, this piece of legislation stands absolutely no chance of passing. And President Biden, of course, came out this week in his speech in Atlanta, Georgia, calling for reform of the filibuster so that we could pass this legislation. And then Kyrsten Sinema happened. On Thursday, Kyrsten Sinema, Democratic senator from the state of Arizona, goes on the Senate floor and delivers a passionate speech about why she simply can't get behind the idea of getting rid of the filibuster, or even reforming it in any way. And here's what she says. I strongly support and will continue to vote for legislative responses to these state laws, of course referring to the Republican voter suppression. I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country, eliminating the 60-vote threshold on a party line with the thinnest of possible majorities to pass these bills that I support will not guarantee that we prevent demagogues from winning office. All right, so she's missed the mark. She clearly doesn't know exactly what is happening here. Because this legislation, the voting rights legislation, is not about preventing demagogues from winning office. That may be a side effect of it, but the point of it is to increase voter participation, not restrict it, which is what Republicans are trying to do. We're trying to make the process of voting more inclusive, expanding it so that everybody that is eligible can participate. Republicans are taking that away. They're taking away voting by mail. They're taking away drop boxes. They're restricting polling hours. They're cutting down the number of polling places in counties. And of course, the counties that they're targeting all happen to be Democratic counties. So no, this isn't exactly about, you know, preventing demagogues. That may be a side effect of it, a positive side effect of it. But that is not the goal of this legislation. The goal of the legislation is to make the process more fair, to include as many people as possible. And Kyrsten Sinema is feeding into those idiotic right-wing talking points. And I don't even know if she realizes it. She's not an idiot. Her statement was idiotic, but she is not a stupid individual. She knows exactly what she's doing. The problem is the rest of us don't. But she doesn't care. She doesn't have to worry about this right now, right? Well, actually, she does. But, you know, this is so typical. This is so typical of these corporate Democrats. And to be honest, it's not just cinema here. Manchin came out on Thursday morning, said he's not going to get behind it anyway. But he didn't deliver this error-filled speech. You don't want to get rid of the filibuster because you don't want to contribute to partisan divisions. Okay, the filibuster is a huge partisan division. The Republicans are using it to block the entire agenda, not because they have legitimate objections to it, but because they're jackasses. Because they don't want to see President Biden have any successes at all so that they can turn around, call him a failure, then win the midterms. That's the point of this. That she is conveniently ignoring, trying to say that, oh, I'm going to preserve this thing. Do you know why, folks? We have the filibuster. Hell, at this point, do you know why we have the Senate even? Go back and look at the history of this institution and why it was created in the first place, along with, you know, why the filibuster is a powerful tool. All of it, every bit of it, comes from racism here in the United States. And it's absolutely insane that we continue to let these racist foundations of not just the filibuster itself, but of the Senate itself, to still call the shots for 330 million Americans. It's absolutely obscene. It is obscene for cinema to come out and give this kind of a speech. And we knew, of course, going into this, this is going to be a long shot. Cinema never wanted to go along with this. Manchin never wanted to go along with this. So if it wasn't her, it would have been him. And because of that, there's going to be massive voter suppression in this year's midterms. There's going to be massive voter suppression moving forward. And there's very little that we can do about it. Without getting rid of that filibuster, we can't move forward on this. Because obviously you're not going to get any Republicans coming along to support it. We can't even get the Democrats to do that. So, I mean, the only solution, of course, would be to vote out every single Republican up for re-election this year. And again, it would have to be every single one of them and get every single Democrat re-elected, get a strong Democratic majority, then the filibuster wouldn't matter. You'd have your cloture vote right there. But that ain't ever going to happen. So, we're stuck. We're stuck at the mercy of these so-called centrists who really are corporatists, who aren't there to legislate. They're not there to help people. They're there to help themselves. And that's the point that we all have to start realizing right now. They're not there to help us. They're there to help themselves. And there's plenty of people in the Senate that fall under that category, plenty of people in the House that fall under that category, and it is what it is. And I don't care which party they belong to, vote them out when you get the chance. It's time. It's time to purge these lawmakers from Washington, D.C. Because the only thing they care about is their next step, their next big payday. So take it away from them. But that's on the voters to do that. We can't force it. We have to hope that when these individuals come up for re-election, whether it's this year, 2 years from now, or even 4 years from now, the voters have to remember this. But in the meantime, what needs to happen to people like Sinema and Manchin is the Democratic Party has to cut them off. That's what has to happen. Chuck Schumer, Democratic leader in the Senate, needs to say, okay, listen, Manchin and Sinema, you guys are obstructing the Democratic agenda just as much as the Republicans are, so I'm taking you off your committees. You're done. You have no power. None. Taking it away from you. Because if you're not with us, you're against us. You know, to borrow that old phrase. And the Democratic Party itself, you know, the DNC needs to tell these individuals, listen, you're going to behave like Republicans? We're not giving you any more money. You're cut off. You're on your own. Maybe it'll wake them up a little bit. Maybe it'll scare them. Who knows? But that is the right path forward. And unless we take that path, get ready for a Republican tsunami later on this year. And of course, speaking of those midterms, right now as it stands, Republicans are poised to make huge gains in this year's midterms. But maybe there's something the Democrats could do to avoid an absolute bloodbath. And joining me now to talk about this is Mike Figueredo, the host of The Humanist Report on YouTube. So, Mike, it's an election year now, officially in 2022. Big one coming up, obviously, and all signs are already pointing towards Republicans at least taking back the House. And some of that is due mainly to gerrymandering. Some of it is just due to general redistricting that's not even, you know, hyperpartisan, but also just historically, the party in power tends to lose the House. I think it's only not happened like three times in history. So even just based on that part, Republicans are probably taking over. But I wanted to get your take on this because this is a big election year and there's a lot of things that could be done that aren't being done. And so where do you think, suppose we hold the election today, where does this land at this moment?
I think it would probably be a bloodbath for Democrats. I would expect them to lose the House, possibly even the Senate as well. And that's even if the conditions were fair, like taking out voter suppression, taking out gerrymandering. I think that the Democratic Party, they just haven't done enough to meet the moment. And part of me, this is a really cynical approach. So you know, brace yourself. I think that a lot of Democrats are comfortable knowing that they will lose because then all of the pressure kind of just goes away. There's this expectation currently that they have to deliver because they do hold all branches of government minus the Supreme Court. So if you take that pressure away and they have a really solid excuse in, well, Republicans control the House, then their base kind of accepts that excuse. Because, I mean, obviously, we know that Republicans aren't going to go along with anything. They're going to obstruct everything. But currently, as it stands now, you know, when they actually can pass legislation, there's a lot of pressure. It's hard to keep scapegoating Manchin and Sinema, and they should be scapegoated. They are absolutely in the way of progress. But there's a lot more that can be done that isn't being done. I mean, we haven't really seen Joe Biden exert pressure on Manchin and Sinema in any meaningful way whatsoever. As president, you have your bully pulpit, so you can't just accept that these two no votes are going to obstruct your entire agenda. You have to push them. You have to fight. You have to go in the media, make your case, go to their home states if need be. But I just haven't seen that from Joe Biden. And if he actually fought, and he tried everything he could, and still Manchin and Sinema are no votes, then you take action via executive order to do everything you can to make a difference before the midterms. I mean, if I were Joe Biden currently, and I actually cared, so this would be a different version of Joe Biden in an alternate universe, I'd be using my pen to cancel student debts. I would be doing everything in my power to make sure that people had additional survival checks. I would be trying to fight with everything that I have to expand the child tax credit for another year. I mean, it should be permanent, but just do everything in your power. And we just haven't seen that from him. And now I think that he kind of sees that the writing is on the wall, hence his speech in Georgia. But I have my critiques of that, and I'm sure we'll get into that as well. But right now, it's not looking good for Democrats. And I think a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are okay with that. I think they're happy about that. Because think about, if you're a Democrat and you don't really want to take action, you don't want to offend your donors, it's easier for you to fundraise off of Republicans obstructing bills that you have that you really want to have a vote on. It's easier to fundraise off of Republicans doing bad things. But it's harder to fundraise. It's harder to convince your base that you're fighting for them if you're in control and you're not doing anything.
Well, you know, there's two big strikes coming up against the Democrats right now. Obviously, as you pointed out, actually, you pointed both of them out. The child tax credit, those payments, those are over with for now. So you just, in an election year, took money out of the pockets of the voters. And then coming up in May, when those student loan repayments start, unless a miracle happens, you're taking more money out of the pockets of American voters in an election year. So even if we were just looking, like if I'm an advisor, a political strategist, and I'm not thinking about the human aspect of any of that, just the optics in an election year, I'm telling this man, listen, you are taking this money away from people. They're going to the polls in just a couple months, and you're sending them there poorer than they were to start this year. That doesn't look good for you politically. So again, that's totally removing the human aspect, the economic aspects of any of that. From a pure political standpoint, that almost feels like suicide, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's political malpractice. It honestly defies logic. It's insane to me. Because, you know, Democrats were rightfully bragging about the effect that the child tax credit had. They were saying it cut childhood poverty in the United States in half. They were correct about that. But now you can't say that because it's gone. So what do you say to voters? Well, I gave you $1,400 checks after promising $2,000 checks way back at the beginning of my administration. I mean, they're going to forget and they're going to feel the differences, the impact on their wallet. It's honestly, I can no longer just assume that the Democratic Party is corrupt and that's why they don't do things that would benefit the American people because they're serving their donors. But it also is just complete incompetence as well. And it's frustrating because there are things that they can do to make our lives better. I mean, currently we're in the third wave of COVID and there has been zero discussion about survival checks. Where are our N95 masks? I mean, it's just there's little things that they can do that they can brag about that they won't do. So I don't know going into the midterms. I don't know what they brag about. If you're a Democrat, what do you say to the American people? Sure, you can say $1,400 checks, but then the question automatically by people are going to be, hey, why aren't we getting another round of $1,400 checks? So the things that they can brag about, it kind of leads to more questions in the minds of average voters because those checks really helped. So I don't know what they're doing, and I don't think that they know what they're doing as well.
Well, and it's not, you know, people also wondering, you know, where's another round of stimulus? First of all, where's the rest of our stimulus from last year? But right. Also, you're shoving us back into work. We have seen such a ridiculous shift coming from the CDC, you know, Fauci himself as well saying, oh, no, everybody, you're okay. You go back to work. They're literally bowing to this corporate pressure after these CEOs came and talked to them in Congress a couple weeks ago. And they said, okay, look, quarantine from 10 days. Now you got 5 days. Oh, no. You're totally safe to go back to work. You're fine. Everybody needs to do this. And they're shoving us back into these situations and getting annoyed when we have teachers walking out of their Petri dish classrooms. So they've done a 180. The agencies overseeing this have done a 180. And what do we get? Okay, well, we get maybe we're going to mail you masks. We're trying to figure this out. Okay, maybe if you have insurance, go buy a COVID test, which you can't find anywhere. And then you're probably going to have to go through this ridiculously lengthy process of filing with your insurance to get a reimbursement. And God only knows how long that is going to take if you can actually do that. So there's just so many missteps that are not even accidental. I mean, this is intentional what they're doing, shoving people back out there as Omicron is just going insane at the moment.
Yeah, and it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what people are dealing with, because assuming that they have insurance, many Americans still do not. Like my mom, for example. If she needs to buy a COVID test, she doesn't have the $20 right now to get reimbursed. So that's the issue, is they still kind of show that they don't understand. And one thing that is just honestly mind-boggling to me is the fact that they have essentially given up on COVID. They're just letting it run its course throughout the country. And this is the Trump strategy. Now, I would argue that Trump lost largely because of the way that he mishandled COVID. Now, Biden still hasn't mishandled it to that extent, but just not letting or not doing anything about COVID is already proven to be a political killer. Like, it's not good for your political career, but that's what they're doing because they've bowed to their corporate overlords, as you've stated. So I don't think that they realize that this has the potential to backfire horribly. I mean, with the CDC cutting down from 10 days to 5 days to appease the Delta CEO, don't they realize that, okay, you're technically getting people back to work quicker since they're not quarantining for as long. But if you're exposing more people, then that means even more outages. So you could exacerbate the problem even further. And it's just, I don't know. It feels like we're living in the Twilight Zone, because you would expect at least some level of competence somewhere in D.C., somewhere. And you just, you see nothing. You see no leadership. You see that essentially you're on your own, you know, when it comes to COVID-19, may the odds ever be in your favor. You know, it's the Shrek meme. Some of you may die, but that's a price I'm willing to pay, from Lord Farquaad. I think I'm butchering the quote, but you know what I mean? It's insanity. It's insanity, Farron.
And, you know, another part of this, if we're talking in terms of the midterms here too, even with all of this COVID, the number one concern, according to polls out this week for voters, is the economy. You know, unemployment, inflation. You know, we got the reports this week, 7% in December. And, you know, a lot of that obviously is due to just the corporate price gouging. But that narrative of the corporate price gouging is not being told, obviously, by the corporate media, because it's the same people that actually own all the shares of these media companies. And so, of course, all of that does get laid down at Biden's feet. Now, the Fed, could they step in and do some things? Yes, you're talking very complicated monetary policy, you know, even things that I don't quite understand, but they can do a little bit. But a lot of this is corporate. But at the end of the day, people do end up blaming the president in power for that. So that's something that's also going to weigh heavily on Biden, whether it's fair or not to do it. He's president. That's bad. It falls on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as much as I hate Donald Trump, tactically, I think he was right to push back against some of the corporate-based narratives. And most of the things that he pushed back on were delusional, obviously. But I mean, I guess what I'm looking for with Democrats is some sign of life, rather than absorbing every single blow. Maybe try to dodge it. Maybe try to push back and say, no, this is why things are the way that they are. Corporate price gouging is an issue. I'm going to push back against that. Here's what my administration is going to do to take measures against these corporations that are gouging customers. But we don't see that. We see no pushback. Every single right-wing narrative that's disseminated, it goes unchecked, until months and months, until it becomes a monster. Critical race theory, you know, cancel culture. So there's no fight. There's no unified message from the Democratic Party. It just feels like there's no real leadership. And the best that we get from Democratic Party consultants is pushing for Hillary Clinton in 2024 so we could have a real leader. I don't understand how things continue this way without the party, just at least some members of the party, you know, aside from the squad and whatnot, thinking maybe we're going in the wrong direction. Maybe it's not voters failing us. Maybe it's us failing to actually deliver. But again, it goes back to the cynicism that I feel, in that I really believe that some Democrats would prefer to just lose, because this is too much pressure, right? You're trying to balance your corporate donors' interests and the interests of voters. And it's hard to prove that you care about voters when you have an opportunity now to deliver for them, but you're not. So it's easier to just not have power.
Right. And that is a good point, too, because if Republicans take back the House, and I know they're confident they can maybe take back the Senate, but that's a much longer shot. They have, you know, almost twice as many seats to defend as Democrats. They've got some people retiring, which costs more money. So taking back the Senate, that's more difficult for them, even though it's a 50-50 split. The House is exceptionally likely to happen. And so, yeah, that does give them this clearance for the next 2 years as they're running for president again to say, listen, I want to do all these great things, but dang it, I've got this Republican Party over here that won't let me do it. So if you vote them out and, of course, vote for me again, then we'll have Democratic control and everything will be great and rosy. And unfortunately, a lot of people will be like, yeah, that sounds right. Democrats just had control of the chambers and the White House. We can totally get stuff done. It's Lucy moving the football from Charlie Brown at this point.
Right.
But the public believes it, though. They think, oh, well, yeah, we would have these nice things if those pesky Republicans were just out of the way. But you're not going to give them a big enough advantage to overcome your mansions and your cinemas for that to ever actually happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really unfortunate that this is the way that it always plays out. You know, I think that the Democratic Party and their base should just expect to lose in 2022. And if they don't lose the House, then great. But use this small window of opportunity to get done what they need to do to at least at a minimum protect democracy. If you're not going to deliver for voters, then at least make sure that Republicans can't just outright steal elections in the future at the behest of Donald Trump. And they're not taking this threat seriously when it comes to voting rights. They aren't putting enough pressure on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And in theory, you think that they have at least a little bit of leverage against the Manchins and the Sinemas of the world because they pay lip service to the idea of voting rights. So, I mean, who knows if you can get Manchin on board, but use his words against him. And you just, you see no fight. And it's shocking to me that they aren't taking this threat seriously. What GOP controlled states across the country are doing, not just voter suppression, but trying to strip power away from local election officials. So in the event there is another Trump loss or a future Republican loss, they can effectively steal the election. It's inconceivable to me that this isn't a hair on fire moment, because they should be fighting to stop that. They're not. I mean, we see a little bit of initiative from Joe Biden with him campaigning for voting rights at ground zero of voter suppression in Georgia. But I even have my issues with that strategy as well, which we can get into later.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, you know what? Let's kind of move into that, because we have to look at it this way. Let's suppose for the last 12 months, Democrats did everything right. OK, we got our good infrastructure bill. We got our stimulus. We got COVID under control, and we got Build Back Better. Democrats would still be at a disadvantage because of all of these voter suppression bills that have been passed in the last 12 months. Georgia, Florida, Texas, a handful of other states trying to get this done right now. And then we're stuck on, you know, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We still can't get that. And even before Biden's speech this week, Manchin said, not changing the rules. And Biden gave a good speech. But even some of the most diehard Democrats out there, like Dr. Jason Johnson, even came out and said, no, this is weak sauce, man. This is pathetic. Those weren't his exact words. I'm just kind of paraphrasing. So if you can't even convince the diehards that you're serious about it, then, you know, what chance do you have of changing the mind of a Manchin or a Sinema on this issue?
Yeah, it's a critical failure. Unfortunately, Dr. Jason Johnson blocked me, but I saw the screenshot and I think he said something to the effect of he didn't hear a plan from Biden. And I agree with him. There's no plan. And part of the problem is if you're going to campaign in Georgia, I guess I don't understand what the value in that is, because the two senators from Georgia, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, they're on board. They support voting rights legislation. They're not the hurdles. You need to be in West Virginia. You need to be in Arizona. Put pressure on Joe Manchin. Let his constituents know how he's failing them. So even when they try to fight, you know, I mean, I guess that it's inherently good that there's some desire to go anywhere other than DC and fight, but it's still a wrong strategy. And you just don't really see Joe Biden doing what he needs to do, which is naming, shaming Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Like, we are witnessing an attack on democracy that we haven't seen in quite some time. And so you need to treat it as serious as it is and call them out every step of the way. As the president, you can control media narratives. All you have to do is say Manchin and Sinema are anti-democracy. And you don't have to say that. Like, that's just an example. You have to say they're siding with Republicans. They're pro-Trump. Say something. Fight. Put that out there so they have more pressure on them. And it's not just, you know, a minimal amount of pressure where they have media teams following them around and they get press. No, actually exert real political pressure on them. And I've seen some people float, Kyle Kulinski, David Dole, that maybe, you know, Joe Biden should use his AG to threaten Joe Manchin. You know, there's a lot of corruption going on. Rolling Stone just released an article about how corrupt Joe Manchin is. And the article is long, but just astonishing. The Manchin family is very corrupt. So use your power to investigate them. I mean, I don't know if that's legally dubious or not, but I want to see something. And what we saw is something, sure, but it's not going to work. Campaigning for voting rights in Georgia isn't going to do anything. You need Manchin and Sinema. Just crack some skulls, metaphorically speaking, of course. It's just I'm so tired. I'm exhausted watching them fumble around, because it shouldn't be this hard. And again, even if you fail at the end, at least I know you did everything that you can. But I can't say that about Joe Biden and Democrats currently in power. I don't think they're doing everything that they can. They're not treating this attack on democracy as the emergency that it is. And, you know, once you go beyond this point, once you pass 2022, assuming Democrats lose power, how are you going to fix democracy? There's no going back. And you already have a huge portion of the population embrace authoritarian measures against democracy, believe in Trump's big lie. It's so hard to undo that. It's so hard to put the cat back in the bag. So you have to protect democracy. And we're at this point where the GOP is just explicitly anti-democracy, and they've even conditioned their base to reject democracy and even become open to the idea of an illiberal regime, which is just shocking to me. And it's an emergency, but they're not treating it like that.
Well, no. And the Republican Party is so confident in victory this year that they already said, we're not putting out a platform. We're literally not even going to run on a unified platform of actual issues, because we don't need to. Like, we don't even have to put out a plan for what we want to do, and we can still win. That is how weak this administration has been, to already be losing to a group who stands for nothing except for stupid culture war BS issues that really don't affect anybody's lives, except, of course, the people that they're trying to oppress. But it's absolutely nuts that we're living through this kind of era right now, where the Democratic Party is so dysfunctional that they can't beat, you know, the party of the Capitol rioters, the party of the big lie, the party of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who says, let's use the Second Amendment against Democrats. I mean, you're losing to that. There's no excuse. There's no excuse. Democrats should be slaughtering Republicans in the polls, and they're struggling to, you know, even get close to being at that level. It blows my mind, the level of incompetence we see from them.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that the Republicans are correct. They don't have to do anything, and they don't. I can't remember the last time Republicans have talked about any policies, even tax policies. All they talk about now is culture war issues, as you said, critical race theory, just things that don't actually matter. And the reason why they don't have to do anything is because they have a base that will consistently vote for them every single election cycle. Democrats have a base that is much more dynamic. So, you know, Democrats, they win by simply getting more people out to the polls. But in order to do that, you have to engage with voters. You have to deliver on policies. I mean, imagine the difference it would make if Joe Biden canceled all student debt. Immediately, you'd have an entire generation of millennials and Gen Zers all galvanized. They'd come out and vote for Democrats, anticipating more policy. I mean, who knows? Maybe that wouldn't be the election winner, but would it improve their chances? Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, who you choose to or whether or not you come out and vote, it's going to depend on if you feel like the people in power are making a difference in your lives. And canceling student debt would make a huge difference. But if nothing meaningful has been accomplished, then you're going to think, am I really going to spend 2 hours waiting in line to vote for Democrats if they're not going to deliver? I mean, no. So they have to excite their base.
They do. And it does come down to, you know, are you better off than you were, you know, 4 years ago, or I guess in this case, 2 years ago? And the public's not going to be able to say yes when November rolls around, you know, assuming things stay on this constant track that we're on right now, which I don't see them deviating off of this. But if they're still struggling, you know, under the burden of student loan debt, no, we're not better off. We were better off when we had it forgiven or, you know, delayed for 2 years, which, for the record, actually helped the economy, didn't hurt it, like, you know, all these people say it would do. No, we haven't made payments in 2 years, but we're told every day the economy's kicking ass. You know, that doesn't make sense. You know, those two things can't go together. But it's going to hurt them if they don't deliver. But there's still a limit on how much help delivering would do. But obviously, it would be a big benefit, whether it lets them keep the House or not. You know, that's a question we're not going to get answered, because I don't see this administration doing enough to actually give the deliverables to the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think that what we're going to see is they won't do anything, even though they've had a lot of warnings. Bernie Sanders, in an interview with The Guardian, warned them. You know, he talked about how you have to course correct now before it's too late. And, you know, they won't do anything, and then they'll lose, and then inevitably we know what will be the discourse. It'll be they went too far left, they listened too much to AOC, and it's so predictable. You know, history repeats itself, they say, but I didn't know that history can repeat itself like every 2 years or every 4 years. It's maddening to me, and it honestly feels like we're living in Groundhog's Day or the Twilight Zone. It's our politics is so stupid right now. And so I don't even know I don't know what the right word is for it. It's so unstable that I feel like somebody has to step up and be the voice of reason. But then whenever that happens, whenever you get a Bernie Sanders, you know, it people freak out and they think, okay, no, I'm focused on electability this time, even though I agree with him. So we have to go with Joe Biden because he's the moderate. And then it's like, oh, okay, no, Joe Biden isn't moderate enough. He's kowtowing to the left. We have to go with Hillary, referencing the Wall Street Journal op-ed. I feel so frustrated.
Well, you know, I want to switch gears, you know, for this last little part here real quick. And I'm going to preface it with this. Obviously last week, you know, Ted Cruz had his oopsie daisy moment where he had to go groveling to Tucker Carlson. But Cruz admitted something during his segment with Tucker after Tucker attacked him the night before. He said, "Tucker, I texted you after your show." And then, of course, we're finding out from the January 6th committee all of this information about Donald Trump and his people at Fox News would call him up, bring him into cabinet meetings via phone. And it reminded me of back in, I believe it was 06, when George W. Bush brought in, I think it was about 8 conservative talk show hosts into the Oval Office, had a strategy meeting with them, talked policy, talked the way forward. And all of that together, I bring all that up because that doesn't exist on the left in any way at all. There's no coordination. And I'm not saying we want to be colluding with the Democrats, but, right. You know, I mean, because we'll get, you know, killed for that. But it is interesting that there is such cohesion between conservative politicians and conservative media. They work hand in hand. But meanwhile, you know, what we do, you and I and everybody else doing this, we get shut out of the game. They don't want to talk mm-hmm. to us. They don't want to waste their time. I'm not going on a podcast, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, all of them are like that, but they'll go on MSNBC every now and then, but I guarantee you they're not texting Rachel Maddow every night asking what we need to do about the border. So I do think that if Democrats want to win, they're going to have to play that Republican game, and they're going to have to start reaching out to some of these, you know, leftist people with these massive platforms. But I don't see them doing that. Do you?
No, I think that they're really stuck in this old school mentality, not just when it comes to new media, but also when it comes to politics in general. I mean, the fact that we're still talking about Bill Clinton-esque triangulation and how that's a feasible strategy in 2022, it just shows that they're not capable of adapting. They absolutely are terrible at messaging. And we all have these ginormous audiences for a reason. We have people engaged. So maybe if they came on our shows, and even if, you know, I would obviously, if I spoke with, you know, somebody from the Democratic Party establishment, I would have to push back hard. But just engaging with us is important. And, you know, I caught that too when Ted Cruz talked about how he was texting Tucker Carlson and how, you know, I thought to myself, I didn't bring this up when I did the segment on it, but I thought, man, they're just openly admitting that they are colluding with members of the media. I mean, isn't that kind of controversial? I remember back in 2016 when articles from The Intercept came out about how Hillary Clinton had campaign surrogates. Yeah, I don't know why that slipped my mind. She had campaign surrogates and they didn't disclose that they were on the Clinton Foundation payroll. That was a huge scandal, and rightfully so, because, you know, you want to make sure that people on the media are unbiased and impartial. But on Fox News, they're not even pretending as if they're not the de facto propaganda arm of the Republican Party. So, I mean, I don't think that we need a mirror image of that on the Democratic Party side. But what Democrats need to do is get more savvy. Their idea of going on a podcast is going on Pod Save America. OK, who listens to that who's under 50 years old? I don't think anyone, like, you, and sure, it's a step in the right direction, right? But they go there, they go on Bill Maher, and that's as much as they'll do in terms of alternative media. But they just, they don't know what venues exist that allow them to communicate with real people, and not just loyalists to them. I think that if they actually spoke with people who would challenge them, but on the left, not like on the right, but people like myself or you spoke with, you know, us, maybe they'd have additional insight. Perhaps they disagree with everything that we said. But just the fact that they're thinking outside the box and they're not just getting that brain rot fed to them that's in DC, from consultants in their ear, it could make a difference. But again, I, who knows with Democrats, because, you know, they're incompetent and corrupt at this point, is a distinction without a difference. I just wish that they would do something to, I don't know, stop us from free falling as a country.
And, you know, not to sit here and just say Bernie Sanders is the greatest person ever, but back when Ring of Fire used to be a nationwide radio show, you know, we would get politicians on regular, you know, fairly regularly. But Bernie Sanders was one of the few people who pretty much, no matter when we asked him, you know, what we wanted him to talk, yeah, sure, I'll come on. Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah. I'll be there. Almost without fail. I mean, it got to the point where it's like, oh, crap, we need another guest. All right, I'll just reach out to Bernie. And he would do it and he'd be great every time. So many other politicians wouldn't do that. And so it, I've seen this now for going on 18 years. And the ones who would come on regularly, Bernie Sanders, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse was always very responsive. But beyond that, we'd have to get, you know, no offense to them, but some, you know, House member from, you know, a rural part of Indiana that nobody's ever heard of. And that was it. You know, the bigger folks didn't want to waste time with it. And we do still see that today. And as you pointed out, it's not just about, hey, let's collude together. It's no, listen to what we have to say. You know, we don't necessarily want to hear from you. We want you to hear from us. And mm-hmm. that would be really the difference between the progressive media doing this and what the conservative media does. Conservative media gives out the marching orders. We just want to be able to let these politicians on the left hear this different perspective that, again, as you said, they're not getting in that DC bubble at all.
You know, part of the problem too is that we oftentimes will say things that are going to conflict with what their donors want. You know, when we talk about climate change and, you know, I talk about just shutting down coal plants right now so we can save the planet, that's not something that is politically expedient for them. In fact, if they hear me say that on my show and they don't push back, you know, perhaps that's a political liability. So, you know, they're a little bit too risk averse. They are worried about, you know, if we're a little bit too edgy, like a Hassan Piker, for example, yeah. You know, maybe that's bad. But, you know, Republicans, they have, I mean, every single Republican will go on Steve Bannon's show, or not every single Republican, but a lot of them, they'll go on Steve Bannon's show, who's a white supremacist, who's literally anti-Semitic, and nobody really bats an eye. So I think that they need to just stop playing it safe, take some chances. And sure, maybe the things that we say, they just disagree with them. They agree with the political consultants who they pay millions of dollars to that lead to them losing every single time. Maybe they agree more with them. But I think that everyone can agree that what they're doing currently is not working. This iteration of the Democratic Party has been an unmitigated failure. And so perhaps we don't have the best answers, but we have a different perspective and we're normal people. We don't live in mansions. We broadcast from our home studios in many instances. We're normal people. And at least let us challenge you. At least don't be afraid to engage with us. But they are. They pretend as if we don't exist. And then they complain when the right wing messaging, you know, just is overwhelming. Well, because you don't have, you know, an appropriate left wing machine to push back against it. We are, I think, a lot more effective at messaging and pushing back on right wing propaganda. It's basically all that we do on my Twitch streams. That's all we talk about is the dumb things that Republicans are saying. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe listen to us if you want to win, but that's assuming they do want to win, because, again, it goes back to my cynicism. I don't think a lot of them want to win. I think they're there for a paycheck. They're there to keep that seat warm as long as they possibly can, and then they'll get a gig as a lobbyist when they're out. So it's kind of like a lose-lose situation regardless, because I don't think we're operating with good faith actors who genuinely care about the country, which is a problem.
It is. And you know, just one more point to make on this. I do think there is a reason, and I know you know this because you were awesome with it in 2020 and beyond that. The people running for office, they reach out to us. They want to talk to our audiences. They want to get their message out. And it is 99% of the time, the people who say, I'm not taking the corporate money, I'm not, you know, employing any lobbyists, I'm an actual independent person with progressive ideals running a non-corporate campaign. Those people do reach out because they understand the value of what we do. And of course, this year, you know, I'm hoping to bring on as many as possible here on Ring of Fire. So if you're out there, you're listening, you're watching, hit me up on Twitter. I'm more than willing to do it. And Mike, I'm sure you're probably the same way, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I will oftentimes, I'll outsource my candidate fielding to people on Twitter. I'll say, hey, who's running? That's good that you want to come on the show. Because there is so many candidates who are running, and we need more Cori Bushes in Congress. You're not going to agree with everything that they do, but the difference between them and your typical Democrat is that these are normal people who actually care about issues. They come in with a real agenda and they have the desire to fight. I mean, Cori Bush, different Cori, was a Black Lives Matter activist. She was on the streets in Ferguson, and you see the difference that that makes, right? I mean, she was sleeping on the Capitol steps for three nights, and she got Joe Biden to extend the moratorium on evictions, specifically just by putting pressure on him. So we need more people like that, real people who actually engage with other real people and not individuals that just kind of get elected and then they go in their ivory tower, place themselves in a bubble, surround themselves by yes men and women, and they never talk to anyone else again. Because even if you go into Congress, you know, with the best intentions, and I would argue that Nancy Pelosi probably went in with the best intentions, eventually you will be corrupted. You'll succumb to DC brain, and that's not good. So it's a constant fight against all of the interests, all of the people in your ear lobbying you, pressuring you, and you have to get out of that bubble. And, you know, I would argue that people in D.C. just don't do that enough, which is why I'm fighting like hell to get as many progressives elected as possible. And it's difficult. Sometimes you have to run more than once. But this time, there's actually quite a bit of people that have a chance of winning. I mean, Donna Imam is one of them in Texas who came really close. And if she were to get elected, she'd be a Texan member of Congress who supports Medicare for All. And this is someone who's sharp. She's an engineer. And she knows how to fight for it. She knows how to market it to conservative audiences, Medicare for All, for example. So we need real people like that in Congress.
All right. So, Mike, tell everybody where they can find you, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, whatever you've got. This is your chance. Go ahead and lay it all out for everybody.
All right, folks. Well, you can see me every day on YouTube, the Humanist Report channel. You can see me on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PST over at twitch.tv/humanistreport, where we just kind of talk smack about Republicans, some lefty LARPers, I call them, you know, who pretend to be leftists in independent media. And we just have a good time. You can also find me on Twitter at Humanist Report, but I discourage people from following me because my Twitter activity is probably not admirable. So I tend to tell people to not go there because I should post too much, but yeah.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me. This is great. And, you know, this is another thing in addition to the candidates, I really want to make these network connections with all the other, you know, leftists who are doing this. And it's always wonderful to talk to you. And again, for the record, I appeared on your show it was Dylan Burns and then Mac, I don't know his last name, but Good Politic Guy is his channel and his Twitter handle. My God, that was the most fun I've ever had in an interview, anything I've ever done. So that was wonderful. That was Dystopian Times. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, is that on your YouTube channel? Can they find that on there?
Yeah, it's on YouTube channel. The old episodes will be archived for Patreon members. But I am going to be doing a season 2 of Dystopian Times over the summer, most likely. I'll switch up the format a little bit and do maybe more one-on-one, more in-depth interviews. But yeah, Dystopian Times, that's a kind of a spinoff of the Humanist Report that I'm doing.
Well, it was a ton of fun. So, Mike, thank you for all your work. Keep it up. beat those YouTube algorithms, because I know we're all getting hammered with it right now. So thanks again, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate the invite. Very fun talking to you, Farron.
And that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. But don't forget, you can get the full show as well as access to all of our Ring of Fire archives by becoming a member. Just go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. And of course, you can get fresh video content from Ring of Fire every single day on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/theringoffire. You can also become a member of that community. Check out the community tab on our YouTube page. Check out the different tiers we have available. Your support is what helps keep us going. And you can follow me on social media. I am on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Farron Balanced. Thank you very much for tuning in to this week's Ring of Fire. We'll be back next week. Enjoy yourselves, and we'll see you then.